So we'd like to do with less. And you can, in fact, using this more general stabilizer system, in fact, you can do it with only 5 qubits. Which is, of course, worse than in the classical case, where you have the repetition code that uses 3 qubits. But you know what you expect. You have to correct more types of errors. You have to correct phase flip errors as well as bit flip errors here. So in accordance with what we've been doing for the past hour and a half, we're going to write down the 5-qubit code by giving it stabilizer. So here it is. When I do this, you could think of each row as a generator and stabilizer and put in a tensor products that I'm not writing down. There's two reasons not to write tensor products. One is to make it clear to look at, and one is to save me writing. And of course, the first column is the first qubit, the second column, the second qubit, and so on. So here we have 4 generators on 5 qubits. So using that notation, this is 5, n equals 5, k equals 1, 1 encoded qubit, right, 5 minus 4. And what's the distance of this code? Well, we can figure it out using this theorem, right? We look at n of s minus s. So it turns out this is going to be a non-degenerate code, so we don't have to worry about this minus s. We look at things that commute with elements of the stabilizer and see if there's any 1-qubit things that do that, and you can easily see that there's not. Or 2-qubit things that commute. And it's a little harder, but that's also true, that there aren't any of those. So for instance, if you take, well, somebody give me a 2-qubit operator here, poly operator.
Y, I.
So Y on the first 2 qubits and I on the other 3. So Y, well, it anti-commutes with x, x, and z, so it's certainly, well, yeah, so, right. So y, so does it commute or anti-commute with this first qubit, the first generator? Well, y anti-commutes here and anti-commutes here, so it commutes. Y commutes with I, but it anti-commutes with x, so it anti-commutes with the second operator. So we already have, we know the second generator can be used to detect y, right? And so on. It also anti-commutes with the third one and commutes with the fourth one. But that, in this case, is not important. So you could go through all these 2-qubit operators and see that they all anti-commute with something. The other way to do this is to write down all the 1-qubit operators and figure out their error synchrons. Right? Like x on the first qubit, x1, well, it has an error synchron 0, 0, 0, 1. Right? Whereas x on the second qubit has an error synchron 1, 0, 0, 0. Because it anti-commutes with the first and commutes with the remaining 3. And if you write down, well, how many errors are there? There's x, y, and z on 5 qubits, so that's 15, plus the identity is 16. So you write down all the 16 1-qubit and 0-qubit errors, you'll find that they all have distinct error synchrons, which is possible because there's 4 bits of the error synchron, which can be 0 or 1. Okay? So this is, in fact, a distance 3 code. And we can look at this to see if this is an example of the case where the x and z corrections are not independent. So this was the thing that Ackerman and Rogel were asking about last week. Right? So when I said in the 9-qubit code the x and z are dependent, what I meant was that there were different generators for the stabilizer that we used to figure out what the x error syndrome was and what the z error syndrome is. Whereas in this case, they're all mixed together, right? Because each one has x and z in the middle of it. So, for instance, this first bit of the error synchron tells us whether there's a z or y error in the first and the fourth qubits, but x error or y error in the second and third qubits. And so we have to combine all 4 bits of the error synchron to figure out where any given x error is or any given z error is. And so it doesn't automatically follow that being able, for general stabilizer code, that being able to correct the x error and z error will allow us to correct the y error, because we might have to once we look at all these bits of the Earth's income, we might run out of information that we that will allow us to distinguish, say, between an X and a Y, or an X on one qubit and a Y on a different. Okay? So this is a 5-qubit code, and there's not really all that much more to say about it. But it's a nice example. Well, that's not true. There is more to say about it, and maybe I will say more later. But it's a nice example of the stable logic code, because it's really using the whole power of the stable logic formalism to get a code that's in fact optimal for correcting the quantum error. Okay, so maybe with this code in mind, it's nice to think a little bit more about the stable logic formalism, about the, in particular, this space N of S that appeared in the theorem. So N of S, so you can apply kind of similar arguments that we used to prove part A to show that while the stabilizer has size 2 to the N minus R, or sorry, 2 to the N minus K, size of the stabilizer is 2 to the N minus K, but the size of N of S, I guess using directly this lemma, right, we can then set E equal to all zeros, right? Everything commutes. And then by using this part of the lemma, we see that there's a 2n minus n minus k. So in other words, n plus k independent q's that will commute with everything in the stabilizer. So n of s therefore has size 2 to the n plus k, because we have n plus k independent ones, so we can again take products of them. Okay? And an interesting thing to look at is this combination, n of s mod s. So why is that interesting? Well, first of all, how big is it? It's 2 to the n plus k divided by 2 to the n minus k, so it's 2 to the 2k. Why is it interesting? Because remember that things in the stabilizer don't do anything to code words, whereas things in n of s take valid code words to valid code words. So n of s we can think of as some kind of encoded operations. But S is a set of trivial operations. At least they're trivial on the code words. So really, N of S mod S is the kind of the unique set of trivial of encoded operations. It's called non-trivial encoded operations. Because if you take two different elements of N of X, say P and Q in N of S, but P is equal to Q times M, with M in the stabilizer, well then, P and Q will act the same way on code words, right? Because M acts trivially on code words, just like the identity. And so that's why we can look at cosets of S in N of S. And why we should look at this coset space, N of S mod S, to tell us about encoded operations. Of course, since we're just thinking about quality operations, these aren't everything. But we can think of them as the encoded polygon. And you see that that's consistent with the size, right? There's k encoded qubits. The polygon has size 2 to the k. Well, OK, up to phases here. So n of s, I guess the way I defined it, we should get rid of these phases. Okay. So let's put that extra factor 4 in here. That's the easy way to do it. So this factor 4 takes care of those phases. OK. Okay. So this is in the encoded polygraph. There's 2 to the 2k different poly operators times factor of 4 for this plus or minus 1, plus or minus I. Right? There's 4 poly operators for each encoded qubit. Okay? So let's think about that in 5-qubit code. All right, I care less in space. Well, okay. And try to figure out what the logical bit flip and the logical phase flip are for the 5-qubit code. Well, there could be elements of N of S. Well, there could be elements of N of S. And then there's some ambiguity in our choice up to multiplication by elements of the stabilizer. So let's find things that commute with all these 4 operators. So one example that we can use for X bar, the logical X. Is just this. Five X's. And you can see that it commutes with everything, right? It commutes with the first one, because the first one has 2 Z's, and they all have 2 Z's at best. So 5 X's will commute with that. And similarly, the logical Z, you can pick to be 5 Z's, because that commutes. But there's some consistency check we have to have, right? Because the logical X has to anti-commute with the logical Z. But you can see, in fact, that it does. Okay. So there's a little more that you have to do, actually, to see that this is really the encoded polygraph. Because how do you know? I mean, you can pick, if you count the dimension here, you know you can pick 2 independent operators that commute. But how do you know that they're necessarily going to anti-commute with each other? Right? Maybe they would both commute with each other. Well, in fact, that's not possible, because the biggest abelian group you can have is only 2 to the n. But if you want to show more generally that you have to write commutation, anti-commutation relation, you have to apply this lemma kind of recursively to pick these x bar and z bar operators one at a time. And then that's relatively straightforward, but I'm not going to do it here. So in general, so far the only part of error correcting codes I've shown you have 1 encoded qubit. But you'll see on the problem set, I'm asking you to find one that has multiple encoded qubits. And that's perfectly all right, right? And then you have multiple X bars and Z bars for the first encoded bit flip and the second encoded bit flip and so on. Okay? Questions? Yeah?
Why don't you find an X bar? Is the Z bar associated with it unique? Or?
Well, so okay. So first of all, none of these are going to be unique because of this mod X. Right? So you could take Z bar and multiply it by any product of these things, and we get another Z bar. That's really the same operation.
Okay.
But more than that, there's also Y bar, right? Which is the X bar times Z bar, or I times X bar times Z bar. Which in this case would be 5 Y's, with some phase out front maybe. Well, I happened to choose this one to be Z bar. I could have chosen the Y bar and said to be Z bar, right? That's just kind of up to me, right? And in fact, I could have chosen these X bar and Z bar to be the other way around. So there's you have a bunch of options. So when you have this encoded polygroup, it doesn't tell you a priori which ones are the X bars and which ones are the Z bars and which ones are the Y bars. You get to choose that. And when you have multiple qubits, it doesn't even tell you which one is X1 and which one is X1 tensor X2, right? Again, you get to choose that. But you have to choose it all consistently. So you have a lot of options, but once you pick something, it all is well-defined and consistent. And the only ambiguity then is this factor of S, the stabilizer. Okay, other questions? Yeah. Yeah, so X is logical thing, so it takes the logical 0 to logical 1. That's right.
So you can't choose X to be Z.
The room of the logical 0 is some complicated encoded state. So it's kind of natural to let the logical X be tensor product of X. kind of an axis that the logical x be a product of x and the logical z be a product of z. But you don't really have to do that, right? It could be that we define the encoded 0 for the 9-qubit code to be, I mean, 9-qubit code, if you looked at that, it involves superpositions, right? And in fact, this logical 0 here will also involve superpositions. So if you just look at them a priori, it's not so obvious what's encoded 0 and what's encoded 1. You can define them to be any linear combination of states in that subspace. Okay, so that's a sense in which it's arbitrary. Other questions? Okay. So maybe then it's time to move on to another set of stabilizer codes. But before I do that, I have to go kind of backwards and teach you about classical error correcting codes. Most people would consider that backwards. But for me, the stabilizer code is a natural thing. The classical code is the special case that, you know, has some, admittedly some interest, but not the main point of the course. OK, we're going to do this. So for those of you who already know this stuff, I apologize, but it won't last long. At which point, I guess I have to apologize for those of you who don't already know it. Okay, this is a question.
Yes. So you're saying when you take one of the logical operations, then mm-hmm. the rest have to satisfy. So is it all in the commutation relations that I have to take care of?
Yeah, that's right. Well, so yeah, so all the commutation relations. It has to commute with everything in the stabilizer. It has to be an N of S. And then it has to have the right computation relations with the x bars and z bars that you've already picked. And those are the only conditions. And once that's true, you're okay. Yeah. Well, it has to be independent. Right? So it can't be a product of things that you've already picked, for instance. So for instance, if there's two encoded qubits, you pick x1 bar, and then you have to pick x2 bar, you should make sure it's something that's different than x1 bar. Kind of. I mean, maybe that's kind of obvious, but it's worth saying. Yeah.
So all the stabilizer formalism seems to follow from the properties of the polygon.
A lot of it, yeah.
So I guess I'm asking, can you derive sort of a parallel theory of a different stabilizer using a different rule?
Well, yes and no. So there's we'll actually discuss some aspects of this when we look at things that are not over qubits, but over higher dimensional space, you know, huge grids or something like that. And what's going to happen is that we're going to take certain properties of the poly group and say, these are the ones we really need. And make sure that we still have those in these other groups. So you can replace the poly group with other sort of groups. Over qubits, there's not really many options. Over higher dimensions, you start to get some options, but there's one that's kind of more common. Then you could kind of start to throw away some of those properties and see what you can do. And there's some work on that, but once you get there, you start to lose some of these nice features of stabilizer codes. Other questions? Yeah.
For any sort of t-bit error, is the stabilizer, the optimal stabilizer code as good as you can do in general?
Well, okay, so there's these three parameters, right? There's N, K, and D. So it is known cases where you can, where that big K can be bigger for a non-stabilizer code than you could get for any stabilizer code. I don't think I know of examples where if you let N and K be the same, where you can get D larger for non-stabilizer code than for stabilizer code. but there might be. I mean, it's just, I don't know. So another interesting thing that's worth noting is there's kind of not really known whether you can do better with degenerate codes than you can with non-degenerate codes. So I guess maybe I should put off saying more about that until we start to talk about the bounds that we know on how good you can do with quantum error. But it's kind of a very interesting open problem. Okay, so other questions on this before I get to classical error? Okay, let's do that then. So what is a classical error correcting code? Well, it's just a sequence of bit strings, or rather, mapping. From k possible states, these are the encoded states, to n bit strings. Okay, but we're not really going to be dealing with the most general classical error correcting code. We're going to be dealing with linear classical error correcting codes. A linear error correcting code has the property that it's closed under addition of these binary vectors that are the code words. Okay. So this is actually taken as a binary error correcting code. Next time we'll actually start to talk about some non-binary codes in order to describe stabilizer code. Okay, so an example, we've already encountered an example of linear classical error correcting code. And since I only showed you one classical error correcting code, it's maybe obvious what it was. It's a repetition code. So the repetition code has two code words. One of them is three zeros, and one of them is three ones. Okay? And you can easily see that it's closed under addition, right? If you add 0 to 0, you get 0. If you add 0 to 1, you get one, all 3 ones. And if you add 3 ones to 3 ones, you get all zeros. So it's binary addition, remember, binary vector. Okay? So maybe that last one tells you that a linear error correcting code always contains the all 0 vector, right? Because if you add anything to itself, you'll get all zeros. So the way we typically deal with these linear codes is by finding a generator matrix. And the generator matrix does the encoding, basically. So if we have some data vector D, which is from our k states. So linear codes, like stabilizer codes, are always going to act on an integral number of bits. So k is going to be 2 to the k. Big k is 2 to the little k. This is a k-bit vector. And so if you have code word x that corresponds to d, we get it by taking the transpose of g and multiplying that by the column vector d. Okay? And so we think of the generator matrix as having rows which are the basis code words. And they're the basis code words in the same sense that the generators and the stabilizer give you the whole stabilizer. If we take sums of these basis code words, we get all possible code words. Okay? So for the repetition code, what is this matrix G? Well, there's only two code words, all zeros and all ones. And so we only need one independent operator, and that's one independent vector, and that's this, 1, 1, 1. Right? And when we multiply by the data, well, the data is either 0 or 1, 1 bit. And so you're going to get 0 times this, and this times 0, which is all zeros, or this times 1, which is all 1s. Okay? Great trivial example. We'll see a more interesting example in a little bit. Okay. And the other important matrix is the parity check matrix. And so we make the parity check matrix. The rows of the parity check matrix are going to be vectors which are perpendicular to the rows of G, in other words, to code words. So H times G transpose is going to be equal to 0. Okay? And so the parity check matrix is going to tell us parity conditions that are satisfied by the code words. So because X is equal to G transpose, for any code word, X is equal to G transpose times D, that implies that H applied to X is equal to H G transpose D, which is equal to 0 times D, in other words, 0. So this is why the parity check matrix is interesting, because when you apply it to code words, you get 0. And the parity check matrix is the classical analog of the stabilizer, or maybe you want to think of it the other way around. Stabilizer is the quantum analog of the parity check matrix. Okay, so the parity check matrix gives you a set of conditions that the code word will satisfy. So for instance, for this repetition code, well, we described it before, right? We said, well, what properties do these code words satisfy? Well, the first two bits are always the same. That's a parity condition. And so we can write that as the row 1, 1, 0. And you see that's orthogonal to 1, 1, 1. And the second two bits are the same. And so that's another parity condition, 0, 1, 1. Right? And so what's it saying is we take the parity of the places where this, in each row, we take the parity of the places where the row is 1. And that could be even parity for a valid code word.
So,
yeah.
From matrix to maximal, that's in terms of dimension.
Yeah, so yeah. So I just want to say that I pick as many possible such rows as I can. But I want them to be independent. Maximal. Yeah, so I don't know. This is classical error correction. I don't want to go into the details of getting all the detailed definitions. But that's what it means. So, in fact, again, by linear algebra, by the same kinds of argument we used before. So Binary algebra, so we have G is going to be, since there's 2 to the k code words, there's k basis code words. So G is a k by n matrix. And there's, so there's k rows. And the number of things that are orthogonal to that, number of vectors, is n minus k, number of independent vectors. So H is an n minus k by n matrix. Okay? And you can see, again, that's true for the repetition code. G was 1 by 3, and H is 2 by 3. Okay. So there are questions on that so far. Okay, so now this is an error correcting code, so what, how do we deal with errors? So for an error correcting code, we can define, again, something that's called the distance, which is going to play exactly the same role as the quantum distance. And the distance is the minimum weight of some vector y such that if we take some code word x and we add y to it, we get some other code word. So, so maybe I should rewrite that to make the existence more clear. So, minimum weight y such that there exists x and x prime. So, when we add two vectors x and y, we're basically taking x and we're flipping the bits in y. So what this definition is saying is that the distance is the minimum number of bits we have to flip to get from some code word to some other code word. Right? In general, of course, getting between two different code words might vary a lot depending on what those two code words are. But we just want to say the minimum number of bits we have to flip to do that for some x and x prime. Right? So this definition of distance is maybe a lot more transparent. It's more obvious why it's the distance than the quantum case. Because this is the distance to get from code word x to code word x prime. OK. And so for linear code, we have this nice property that if x and x prime are both in the code, then x plus x prime is in the code. So if we subtract x from the left-hand side, well, subtraction for binary arithmetic is the same as addition. So we can just then add it to the right-hand side, and we get that y is equal to x plus x prime. That's true in general. But for linear code, that means that y is actually in the code. So for linear code, the distance is the minimum weight of x that's in the code. Well, except for the zero vector. Right, which has weight zero, kind of period. Okay, everyone see that? So we can immediately see that the distance of this repetition code, since there's only two code words, is 3. And so just as before, we had this notation that NKD for general error correcting code, this is physical bits, and this could be 2 to the k, number of encoded bits, or number of encoded states in this case. And this here is the distance. And little k d for the linear code. Okay, and there you see the single parentheses and single brackets. Okay? So now let's go a little deeper. And you can see that the distance, So this property that the H and G matrices are orthogonal to each other creates kind of a lot of interesting structure, which is what makes classical error correcting, classical linear error correcting codes so interesting, or at least one of the things that makes them interesting. And so one of those interesting properties is that the code words, because they're orthogonal to all the parity, the rows of the parity technique tricks, they give us linear dependencies on the columns of the parity check matrix. Okay, so we can see that for the repetition code, right? So this code word 111, well, okay, first of all, the code word 000, that's a trivial linear dependence, right? Says if you take nothing and you add it up, you get 0. Okay, but this one is more interesting. It says that if you take the 3 columns of the parity check matrix and you add them up, you should get 0. And you do, right? Because you get 2 ones in the first row, 2 ones in the second row. Okay? And so combining this property with this fact, that tells us that the distance of a classical linear code is equal to the minimum number of columns of the parity check matrix that are linearly dependent. Okay, so that gives us a criterion that you can start to look at to try to make better codes than this repetition code. So if you want a code with a really good distance, you should try to choose columns of this parity check matrix in such a way that they're basically linearly independent of each other. You have to take lots of them before you get something that's linearly dependent. Okay, so in particular, it's very easy to come up with a distance 3 code. So for distance-free code, well, we're allowed to have three columns linearly dependent, but we shouldn't have any two columns linearly dependent, right? Which is just saying that no two columns in the firing type matrix should be the same. And of course, we can't let them be zero, column be zero either, because that would, by itself, be linearly dependent. Okay? So this suggests a way to define a very nice class of classical error corrected codes, of linear codes, called the Hamming codes. So we'll let the columns let the columns of the parity check matrix be all distinct vectors of length r. So for instance, so it turns out actually the repetition code is a Hamming code with r equals 2. So let's look at the next one, the interesting one with r equals 3. Okay? So here's going to be our parity check matrix. Well, so actually I want to write it from the back because this is the way I normally write it, but it doesn't really matter. So we start with 0, 0, 1. That's one possible column. 0, 1, 0. We're just counting in binary. 0, 1, 1. 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1. And now we're out, right? We have no more possible independent vectors. And so if you think about it, if you have vectors of length r, well, we can't have all zeros, but we can have everything else. So we're going to have n, in general, is equal to 2 to the r minus 1. Okay? And we have r rows of this parity check matrix. So k is going to be, well, it's going to be n minus r, right? Because by this. Okay? And so this gives us a parity check matrix, which defines a distance-free code. So let's figure out what the generator matrix is here. Well, so we want to find, in this case, 7 minus, so this is 7 bits. This is going to be a 7, 4, 3 error correcting code. So we want to find 4 rows that will be orthogonal to these 3 7-bit vectors. Well, so one thing, if you look at this, you'll see that all of these rows have 4 ones in them. So therefore, the vector of all 1s, of 7 1s, is going to be orthogonal, right, log 2. And we still need to find 3 more. But it turns out, if you look at these, that these vectors are orthogonal to each other. So we can just write them down again. So 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0. It's orthogonal to itself, it's orthogonal to this, it's orthogonal to this. 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1. Okay? And that's the generator matrix for the 7-bit code, 7-bit Hamming code. Okay? Questions about that? No? You look like you might have a question, but you don't know what to ask.
Isn't it 2 in the middle? Because it's little k? Because you're in total?
No. So So, sorry, I don't even know how you're getting two. There's n is 7 in this case. Mm-hmm. There's three rows, so 7 minus 3. Oh, I see. I see the problem. So, so this was little k.
Okay.
And here, this was little k here. So the point is that the rows of the generator matrix are linearly independent from the basis code words. And you can get the other code words by taking linear combinations. So another code word, so there's actually 2 to the 4, there's 16 code words of the 7-bit code. And so, for instance, you can take this plus this and get 0011110, which you'll see is also orthogonal to everything up here. Okay. Good. Other questions? Okay. Everyone seems happy with this? Okay. So, need more space. Okay, so there's one more thing I want to define for classical codes, and that's the dual code. So the dual code of a code, the dual code C perk of a linear code, anyway. Is another linear code whose generator matrix is the parity check matrix of C. Okay? And it's also true that C perk is equal to C again. So C perk is switching the generator matrix and the parity check for the original code C. Right? Whereas for C, we use G to give us the code words and H to tell us what the parity check is. For C perk, we do it the other way around. So the dual to this 743 code is a code with 3 encoded bits. And it's not so obvious what the distance actually is in the dual code, in general. In this particular case, it's, I think, actually distance 4. But, we won't really need to go into the details. So the dual code consists of code words that are all perpendicular to the code words of the original code, which is kind of where the name dual comes from. Okay, so once you have a graph of the parity check matrix and generator matrix, this is a fairly easy notion, and at least the way we'll be using it is fairly easy. Okay, so you just switch from the two. Okay. So like I said, this is the last thing I want to define, and so now we can start going back to quantum codes. But as kind of a halfway step to doing that, I want to think about these linear classical error correcting codes as quantum codes, as stabilizer codes. In just the same sense, the very first error correcting code we saw was this repetition code, the 3-bit code, extended to act on superpositions. So if we were to do that, what would happen to its parity check matrix? What would become the stabilizer of a quantum code? So I said before that I thought of classical error correcting codes as special case of final codes. And in particular, linear codes are a special case of stabilizer codes. So we can see that by taking the parity check matrix. And converting it to the stabilizer, or to a stabilizer, as follows. So the rows of the parity check matrix get converted into generators of the stabilizer. Okay? And the way we do that is we take the ones in each row and convert them into z's in that generator. Okay? So if we were to do that for the 7-bit code, what would we get? We'd get this stabilizer. So the first row is 4 ones and then 3 zeros. So we have 4 z's and then 3 i's. The second row is 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0. The third row, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1. Okay? And this is the stabilizer that corresponds to that parity check. And in fact, the eigenvalues, getting a plus 1 eigenstate of these three operators, is the same as taking a state that satisfies a classical bit string that satisfies those parity checks, right? Because, for instance, let's do a for instance. So, for instance, this operator, z, 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 says, well, we take a plus 1 whenever we have a 0 and a minus 1 whenever we have a 1. That's what z does. So, if we have an even number of 1s, then we have eigenvalue plus 1 on these first 4 qubits. An odd number of 1s, we have an eigenvalue minus 1. And so that's what the parity check does, right? It says if you have an even number of 1s, we have even parity, and an odd number of 1s, we have odd parity. And in general, that's exactly what we're doing. Where the 1s are, we say if we have an even number of 1s in those locations, we have even parity. And eigenvalue plus 1 over here. And an odd number of 1s, odd parity, and eigenvalue minus 1. Okay? So when we've done this, we haven't changed the code at all. We've only extended it kind of to allow superpositions in the encoded state. Everyone understand that? And so we know automatically that this is a code that a quantum thing can correct 1-bit flip error, right? Because the classical code had distance 3, and so it could therefore correct 1-bit flip error. And since it's the same code, it should still be able to do that. Okay, but we can go further. So there's no reason that we have to restrict ourselves to just correcting bit flip errors. We could do the same thing and correct phase errors, which is, again, what we did last week, right? We said, well, if we can do this with bit flips, we can do the same thing with the other basis and correct phase flips. So to do that, we convert the ones in the parity check matrix not to z's, but to x's, right? Z's are used to detect bit flip errors, and therefore, if we do that, we'll correct bit flip errors. But if we just want to correct phase errors, we should convert to x's. Right? And so if we do that with a 7-qubit code, we'll get this stabilizer. Okay? Everyone see that? Questions?
Yeah,
But this is still really just, I mean, it corrects phase errors now. So in that sense, it's really quantum. But in another sense, it's really just the classical error correcting code again. OK. But let's get greedy. We don't want to correct just bit flip errors or just phase errors. We want to correct both at once. So let's put both of these together into the same stabilizer. So in general, we don't have to use the same code. This will be our code C1. Actually, let's call this C2. Just kind of arbitrarily. So we use C1 to correct bit flip errors, and C2 to correct phase errors. Okay? And then if we have both a bit flip and a phase error, a Y error, well, we can correct that too, because the Y, well, we break it up into an X part, which was corrected from these, and a Z part that's corrected up here. Okay? So in general, we can take, so this is called the CSS code, which is named after his discoverers, Alderbank, Shore, and Steen. It's a general class of codes formed from two classical linear codes. So we take them and form a stabilizer code as above. And then we get a quantum code. So what are its parameters? What are its properties? Well, so if C1 is an n, K1. So obviously, the way I've constructed it, they have to work on the same number of physical qubits, right? Because otherwise, you can't really do this. It doesn't make sense. But they don't have to be the same code, although in this case, they were. And so they don't have to have the same number of encoded number of bits, encoded bits. So C1 can be N K1 D1, and C2 is N K2 D2. And so then the CSS code is, well, what are its parameters? Well, it clearly has the same number of physical qubits as the original ones had bits. But what's K? Well, let's think about it. So this has, so this is C1. So this is N minus K1 rows. And this has N minus K2 rows. So the new stabilizer has the sum of those two, 2n minus k1 plus k2. And so the number of encoded qubits is n minus that, which, if you do the arithmetic, is k1 plus k2 minus n. So obviously, you can't do this unless k1 and k2 are sufficiently large. Right, because if there's too many parity checks, you're going to run out of space, and you won't have any encoded qubits left over. Okay, and then what's the distance of this code? Okay, well, what do we think? Well, if you have bit flip errors, we can correct them using C1, right? We said that. And if you have phase errors, we can correct them using C2. And C1 has a distance for correcting bit flip errors that's D1. C2 has a distance for correcting phase errors that's D2. And y errors, well, that could be either. So what's kind of the distance for correcting the arbitrary polio? Well, it could be the worst of those two, right? So obviously, if you know C2 is really lousy distance and it can't correct any phase errors, then this code we get is not going to correct phase errors. So it's not going to have a good distance. But on the other hand, if they're both really good at correcting errors, then we can correct lots of bit flip errors and lots of phase errors, and therefore lots of y errors. Okay? So D is going to be at least the minimum of D1 and D2. So you might ask, why is it greater than or equal to? But if you were to ask that, I wouldn't answer because it's on the problem set. I've given you an example where you'll see the distance is actually greater, the CSS code is actually greater than the minimum of these two distances. And that example is the non-cube encoding. So I want you to think about why that's true. Okay? So is everyone happy with this? Yes? You shouldn't be happy. Because there's something that I left out, something very important. What is that?
One code is in the other?
One code is in the other. So in what sense?
Yeah, that's one of the premises.
Yeah, so you're just remembering something. You did. Okay, so... maybe one reason you can't figure it out is because the appropriate part has probably been erased. But yes, it's been erased. Okay. So the problem is that you can't just take an arbitrary list of poly operators and get a stabilizer out of it. Remember, it had to satisfy some properties. So what properties did it have to satisfy? Well, the important one, the one that's not automatic in this case, it has to be a Boolean fruit, right? And so if we just do this and convert ones into z's, it'll automatically be a Boolean because z's commute with each other. And similarly, if we convert to x's, we'll be okay. But if we do both at once, x and z don't commute. So what we have to be careful is that these operators in C2 will commute with these operators in C1. Okay? So how do we ensure that? Well, okay, so for this particular case, let's try it, right? We can just do it explicitly. And we see that, in fact, they do. Right? That, for instance, this one, ZZIIZZI, commutes with this first one, XXXXII, because here we have XZ, here we have XZ, and then commute, etc. Okay? And if you try all pairs like that, you'll find that they all commute. So this is actually fine. And so this gives us a quantum code. This is a 7-qubit, 1-encoded qubit, because there's 6 generators, and distance 3. This is the case where the distance actually is equal to the minimum of these two distances. This is a 7-qubit code. It's a very interesting and useful code, even though it's not quite as efficient as a 5-qubit. But in the general case, we still have to worry about this. We don't want to necessarily work from scratch. So is there some property we can figure out that will happen automatically from the properties of the classical code, or the two classical codes? So how do we ensure that the stabilizer is doing it? Well, one way to do it is to think about this binary vector representation. Okay? So the binary vector representation of a CSS code is particularly simple. So up here we'll have C1, and down here we'll have C2. And for For C1, all we've done is we've taken the parity check matrix of C1 and put z's in place of the 1's. Which means that if we convert that back to this binary vectors, we're replacing the z's back with 1's over here. And we have zeros here. Okay? And similarly for C2, except that it's in the x part. Okay? And so to see if things commute, we just apply a symplectic inner product, which in this case is just a regular inner product. So the generators will commute if and only if the rows of H1 are orthogonal to the rows of H2. In other words, if, so remember the things that are orthogonal to the rows of H1 is the generator matrix of H1, the rows of the generator matrix of H1. So in other words, we're saying that the rows of H2 are, or at least linear combinations of the generator matrix of G1. So that's saying that C2 per, the thing that has this generator matrix in C2, is a subset of C1. So that's what we need to add here. We have two codes, C1 and C2, and C2 perp is a subset of C1. And when that's true, we're getting an abelian stabilizer. And I have to say there's a symmetry here, that if you take the perp of both sides of this equation, it's also true that C1 perp is a subset of C2. Yeah?
Silly question. Why'd you put why'd you make this matrix not diagonal? Why didn't you put the H1s and the H2s
in the original? That's just the way it turned out. Okay. The various conventions that I've been using accumulated this way. And so in the first part, I had an X's on the left and the Z's on the right. And then here, I decided to define C1 to be the Z's and C2 to be the X's. And so that made it.
Okay.
There's no reason. Just conventions. Yeah.
Does this mean that Hamming codes with themselves always form?
Yes. So in fact, the Hamming codes are what's called weakly self-dual. So they have this property that that for Hamming codes, C perp is a subset of C. And so therefore, you can use the same code twice and get a quantum character code. I can say that when this condition is true, you'll automatically have that this will be greater than or equal to zero. And in fact, you'll find that if you look at this coset, C1 mod C2 per, then this is equal to 2 to the k, where k is that number of encoded qubits. Okay, and this has a real meaning because the code words of the CSS code can then be written. Well, okay, so if we write them, we can assign these code words in kind of the same way we define these x bars and z bars. We can associate them with these cosets, C1 mod C2 bar. So let's take some x, where x is in this coset, and the encoded, the CSS code word, is then going to be a superposition. Well, okay, so the code words have to satisfy the Z parity checks, which says that they're all kets in the superposition will be code words of C1, right? They have to satisfy the parity checks of C1. But they're shifted by, but they have X's, which cause shifts in C2. So what we have is something of this form, plus x. A superposition of u plus x but for all u in C2 perf. And so that's why we have to look at this, well, that's one reason we have to look at this coset, right? Because if we were to shift this x by some element of C2 perf, we just get the same combination there. Right? So the CSS code words, this was actually how they were originally defined. They were defined before stabilizer curves. They're written as superpositions over cosets of this subcode, C2 perf, within this larger code, C1. And the different cosets correspond to different basis encoded basis states. Okay? So we'll be coming back to this problem later on. Because it's one of the reasons that CSS codes have some interesting properties that make them very useful for fault tolerance. Are there questions on that? Or questions on the previous stuff? No? Okay. Then let's call it a day. So reminder, if you haven't turned in your problem set, if you're taking the course for credit and haven't turned in your problem set, please do so. If you're not taking the course for credit, please don't turn in your problem set so I don't get confused and grade it, which is fine for you but bad for me. And also pick up solution set for the first problem set and the next problem set, which is the next good day.